We're going to be looking at verses 1 through 11, and just the first part, actually, of the message, Paul's address to the wild crowd. And it was a wild crowd we saw in the last chapter. Let's review just a bit from last time. And Acts chapter 21 through verse 40 there, the end of the chapter, we looked at that. We saw, first of all, in verses 27 through 32, the riot. And so, you know, many times when Paul went somewhere, he inspired a riot. Well, and a lot of times it was Jewish-inspired riots. And we have the same thing again. We found out in verses 27 and 28 of chapter 2 that it was based on a false accusation. Notice chapter 22, chapter 21 and verse 27, what the text says here. When the 7 days were almost over, okay, so Paul, you know, some Christians very zealous of the law think that you are saying to them, do not obey the law. Do not do anything that conforms to the law. Don't do any of that. Well, Paul wasn't saying that. And they understood that, the leadership in Jerusalem. But what they said is, well, in order to kind of correct that, we have a few fellas here looking to fulfill a vow. We suggest you go with them and pay for them, because they had taken a Nazirite vow. And part of the Nazirite vow was they had to buy some animals and then they had to sacrifice those animals. Okay, there was a whole process. I'm not going to get into that. But Paul, we suggest you finance it. And it would be a substantial amount of money. So this is going to prove to them Paul is not anti-Jew. Paul is not conforming to some of those things if they want to, voluntarily, all right? Paul was not someone that said, you have to do it, because they're not under law, they're under grace, okay? Paul was not an individual who would say, for instance, to the Gentiles, you have to do this. No, but was it allowed if a Jewish person wanted to celebrate? Yes. By the way, that happens today. There are Jewish people who are Christians that want to celebrate Hanukkah. Is that sinful? No, I don't have a problem with that. In fact, in many ways, their celebration of Hanukkah is a lot more spiritual than our celebration of Christmas is in our culture. I don't have any problem. I could celebrate with them. I have no problem with that at all. In fact, it'd be kind of fun. So there's no problem with that. So Paul is not anti-Jew. He's not anti-Jewish culture. For them, it was part of culture, too. He was not don't ever follow the law if you desire to do so. You know, if you desire to celebrate this feast or have this vow to the Lord, and as he was doing here, don't feel like you can't do that. That's all right, okay? So they suggested, the leadership in Jerusalem, Paul, you need to go with these men. You need to shave your head, do all the things that they were doing, pay for their sacrifices, and it's going to convince people, all the critics, that you are not against this. And so Paul decided to do it. And we find, again, in verse chapter 21, in verse 27, when the 7 days, this was of this fulfillment of this vow, were almost over, the Jews from Asia, upon seeing him in the temple, so they're expecting it's going to settle things down. It does just the opposite. Began to stir up, by the way, I think it did help with the Christians, because we don't see them objecting. These are pagans here. These are people that did not want to accept the message of the gospel. They began to stir up the crowd and laid hands on him. Verse 28, crying out, men of Israel, come to our aid. This is the man who preaches to all men everywhere against our people. He's anti-Jew. and the law. He's anti-law and this place. He's anti-temple. And besides, he has even brought Greeks. Well, that's a complete lie. Brought Greeks into the temple and has defiled this holy place. In other words, he's gone beyond the court of the Gentiles. He's brought a Gentile into the inner part of the temple. And so he has desecrated the temple. Again, a complete lie based on a misunderstanding. And I don't think, it may have been a misunderstanding, but I think they were sure willing to go along with it very, very quickly. In verse 28, it says, this is the man who preaches to all men everywhere against our people, against the law, against this place, against the temple. He's brought Greeks into the temple. Again, clearly this was not true. And then notice in verse 29, it was caused by a faulty observation. Notice verse 29, for they had previously seen Trophimus, the Ephesian, a Greek, in the city with him, and they supposed that Paul had brought him into the temple. Now, why? Okay, I see the two of them together. I bet he brought him into the temple. I mean, it really is a foolish thing to bring together here. It doesn't make any sense. So Trophimus, one of Paul's companions, and you know Paul had said in Ephesus to the Ephesians, he had said that God had broken down the wall between the Jews and Gentiles. And maybe they're thinking, oh, Paul brings Gentiles right into... That isn't what Paul was saying in that letter. Maybe they were thinking, though, you know, and that message had gotten out. You know, maybe Paul is bringing, you know, Gentiles into the Jewish part of the temple. Well, again, the unbelieving Jews may have even known this guy Trophimus. They were from that area. And for some reason, because of the association between Trophimus and Paul, they automatically jumped to the conclusion that Paul had brought Trophimus, who was a Greek, not a Jew, from the court of the Gentiles and into the actual temple area itself. And this was against Jewish law. It would have defiled their holy place. Paul would never have done this, but they accused him of it. And then we find out in verse 30, it led to a provocation. Verse 30, and all the city was provoked. And the people rushed together, and taking hold of Paul, they dragged him out of the temple, and immediately the doors were shut. So taking hold of Paul, they dragged him out of the temple. Presumably, they dragged him out of one of the inner courts and into the court of the Gentiles. And behind him, they shut the gates or the doors behind him. According to Jewish law, no man's blood could be shed in the inner court. So they want Paul dead. And so they drag him into the court of the Gentiles where it would be legal to kill him. Verse 31, we find out it resulted in a Roman communication. Well, all of this craziness came to the Antonio Fortress, where the Roman army was. Verse 31, while they were, by the way, it was adjacent to the temple. We showed you some diagrams of that several times ago. While they were seeking to kill him, a report came up to the commander of the Roman cohort that all Jerusalem was in confusion. Sir, all Jerusalem's going crazy. Well, what's going on? You know, what's happening? Verse 32, it brought about Paul's salvation or deliverance. At once he took along some soldiers and centurions and ran down to them. We got to find out what's going on. We're supposed to keep peace here. This is crazy. A riot is breaking out. They're going to kill somebody. We need to find out what's going on. And when they saw the commander and the soldiers, they stopped beating Paul. So they start beating Paul, intending to kill him. And then when they saw the commander, he's the big guy over there in the Antonio Fortress, all right? He's the main guy. They knew who he was. And he's bringing soldiers. They thought, whoa, you know, maybe we're in trouble for causing a ruckus here. And, you know, he's coming to take care of it. So they stopped immediately. And so they stopped beating Paul. So that's it. It brought about his deliverance here because of this. And then we see the arrest in verses 33 through 40. We see, first of all, in verses 33 through 36, the Romans attempt to get to the crux of the issue with the Jews. In verse 34, it says, "But among the crowd, some were shouting one thing and some another, and when he could not find out the facts because of the uproar." So, you know, here's the commander trying to get to the crux of the problem. He can't. Because everybody, "Oh, he's this. Whoa, he's that." They're shouting one thing and another. It is so crazy, he can't even sort it out. They were angry. They were shouting maybe even, you know, contrary things to each other. Who knows? Some were not even sure why they were there. The Greek word translated uproar means a raising of voices that contributes to a lack of understanding. Noise or clamor. So, all right, we're going to have to get them out of this fracas. We're going to have to get them out of this riot. So he ordered him to be brought into the barracks. We got to sort it out in a quieter area. The commander can't figure out what's going on. Verse 35, when he got to the stairs, he was carried by the soldiers because of the violence of the mob. Here they're probably trying to grab at him or whatever. So the soldiers grab him and physically begin to carry him at the stairs. And then notice B here, verses 37 and 38, the apostles' interaction with the Romans. So Paul spoke to the commander in Greek. And he requested permission to say something, and so surprised him. In the very next verse, we see that by this time, the commander assumed that he was an Egyptian insurrectionist. I guess, you know, he was very familiar with this. There was an Egyptian insurrectionist who had not yet been captured by the Romans. And the commander's figuring this is probably the guy. You know, he's the insurrectionist. That's why they're so upset. That's why there's a riot. But apparently the Egyptian rebel could not speak Greek. So when Paul speaks Greek to him, it's like, whoa, who is this guy? This can't be the same guy. See, verses 39 and 40, the apostles' request to speak to the crowd. Let's look at verses 39 and 40. This is our final two here to introduce tonight. "But Paul said, 'I'm a Jew of Tarsus in Cilicia, a citizen of no insignificant city, and I beg you, allow me to speak to the people.' When he had given him permission, Paul, standing on the stairs," now he's on the stairs of the fort of Antonia, so he's up a little ways so people can hear him, the men can hear him, "motioned to the people with his hand," okay? "And when there was a great hush, he spoke to them in the Hebrew dialect, saying," and tonight we're going to look at what he said. But notice, first of all, in verse 39, "I'm a Jew of Tarsus in Cilicia." This is how he knew Greek, okay? He was a citizen of Tarsus. It was an important city. It had a good reputation, particularly in the area of education. And so he says, "I beg you, allow me to speak to the people." Brave request on the part of the apostle. In the middle of a riot, I want to speak to him. Well, I guess what has he got to lose? He allows Paul to speak. And again, the text says in verse 40, he spoke in the Hebrew dialect. And I think this clearly indicates the Aramaic language. It might have been aromatic if he had a lot of garlic. It's the Aramaic language. Fruchtenbaum believes he actually spoke in Hebrew. I don't think so. Aramaic language was considered a Hebrew dialect that they would speak. So I think he's clearly talking about Aramaic here. Now we see this afternoon what Paul says to the crowd. And first of all, we notice verses 1 through 5, Paul's Jewish background and former life. So now he's going to explain to this crowd who he is. They don't seem to understand exactly who Paul is, what his background was. And what he's seeking to do here is to establish common ground with these people. He's not some, you know, weird cultist. He's not some guy that would go about and, you know, violate the law by bringing a Gentile into the temple. He wouldn't do that. So he's trying to explain to them his background. He is a Jew, okay? He explains to them his former life because, as Paul always does, he's going to share his testimony with them. Isn't that amazing? Even in this, Paul is thinking about the gospel. Even in this, Paul is thinking of sharing the gospel with other people. Let me ask you a question. Are you always thinking about that? Paul was. Are you always looking for opportunities and open doors to share the gospel? How about just inviting someone to church? Even just that. You know, one of the things I keep hearing about, I think it's Gen Xers, I keep hearing about, they just want to be invited to church. By the way, I do, and people don't come, but part of it may be Connecticut, New England, I don't know. But they say, we just want to be invited, and we come if you invite us. Well, nothing wrong with inviting people, and I agree with that. I think we ought to be doing that. I'm not sure it's always going to work magically by just inviting someone, but the Holy Spirit does work through us, and he can work in people's hearts. And for sure, if we could give a testimony of Christ to others, what a wonderful thing. Well, Paul was always thinking about giving a testimony to other people, even in the middle of a riot. Let me ask you a question. Had you been the Apostle Paul in the middle of this riot, would you be thinking about turning around? The soldiers have grabbed you. They have begun going up the stairs. You're at the stairs. You want to turn around and address the crowd. Would you do that? They could come at any moment and grab you and rip you apart. Is it so difficult for us just to share the gospel with someone who might say something negative? Probably not, you know, we're probably not going to start a riot and be ripped apart. Now, there may be some day we'll do that, okay? Our society is becoming so anti-God and so anti-Christian, there may be a day when that will happen. But, you know, as of right now, we still do have some freedom of speech. And the fact is we need to use that. So we see now Paul relating his former life to them. First of all, in verse 1, "Brethren and fathers, hear my defense which I now offer to you." And notice he begins with brethren and fathers. The Greek here literally says men, brothers, and fathers. I think, first of all, he begins with an overall term, men. He's talking to men here. And then he talks about brothers and fathers. Well, what does he mean? He's got his own brothers in front of him? Is that what he's saying? No. By the way, this is the same wording that Stephen used when he was arraigned before the Sanhedrin with Paul present. Stephen's testimony and martyrdom, no doubt, had a lasting impression upon the Apostle Paul. Imagine that. His words were courteous. They were polite. They were tactful. That is indeed instructive to us. These men before whom he spoke were both his Jewish brothers. There it is. That's what a brother is. As well as some who were Jewish leaders or fathers, okay? They were Jewish leaders or fathers of one sort or another. In other words, they were priests and rabbis and members of the Sanhedrin. So Paul is aware of who he's talking to here at this point. Verse 2. "And when they heard that he was addressing them in the Hebrew dialect, in Aramaic, they became even more quiet." Kent explains, when Paul began his explanation, his use of Aramaic, the Hebrew tongue at this time was Aramaic, okay, rather than the more cosmopolitan Greek, took the crowd by surprise. So they quieted down when they heard him speaking the way he was. And he goes on, and they gave him their attention. So by knowing Aramaic, and by using the Aramaic, he caught the crowd by surprise, and they perked their ears up. They were willing to listen. So Paul begins to relate his defense to them in their mother tongue. And in verses 3 through 5, he now relates to them his early pre-conversion life. He relates four areas of his early life to which they could very easily relate and for which he might gain some respect. He's showing himself to be an absolute model Jew. Number one, he's going to tell them his lineage. Number two, his birthplace. Number three, his teacher. And number four, his ambitions and zeal. And with this background, it would no doubt draw out their curiosity as to how and why such a change took place in his life. How could a man like this end up the way he is today? I'm sure it didn't make sense to a lot of people, and it drew their attention. Verse 3, I am a Jew, born in Tarsus of Cilicia, and brought up in this city, educated under Gamaliel. Well, that would have perked their ears up. Strictly, according to the law of our fathers, being zealous for God, just as you all are today. I'm like you are. I was just like some of you standing in front of me, Paul is saying. He says, I am a Jew born in Tarsus of Cilicia, but notice I was brought up in this city. What city? Jerusalem. Okay. I was part of the diaspora. Okay. I was born in Tarsus of Cilicia, but I was brought up here. I was brought up here. So he was a foreign-born Jew, but he was educated in Jerusalem. And he was brought up in this city, in Jerusalem. Notice, too, Acts chapter 26 and verse 4. Turn there for a minute. Acts chapter 26 and verse 4. Did the internet just go out again? Look like it, yeah. I should have kept the appointment, huh? Acts chapter 26 and verse 4. So then all Jews know my manner of life from my youth up, which from the beginning was spent among my own nation and at Jerusalem. Now, the texts don't indicate how young he was, but in his youth, he went to Jerusalem. A.T. Robertson, that famous Greek scholar, suggests that maybe he was 13 or 14 years old. Well, maybe, okay? He would have been considered old enough to do that kind of thing, to go and be trained under the Jewish law. So perhaps Paul was 13 or 14 years old when he moved from Tarsus to Jerusalem to be educated. And notice he was educated under Gamaliel. Under Gamaliel is literally at the feet of Gamaliel. In fact, I think the King James says at the feet of Gamaliel. And this is actually more significant than what you think. The rabbis would sit in a raised seat with their various pupils gathered around them in a circle on lower seats, or maybe they were actually sitting on the ground. It's like we have teachers today sometimes call the kids over to sit around them. Well, these rabbis would do just that too as they were training their students. And, you know, school wasn't having a bunch of teachers. It was being mentored by one man. And so they would be taught by this man, Gamaliel. The last time we see Gamaliel, and if you'll recall, he was giving advice about Peter and the apostles in chapter 5, verses 33 through 40. Remember that? Basically, he said, let them go. Let these disciples go. If it is a movement that is of God, it will succeed. If it's not, it will be defeated. So Gamaliel was kind of a peacekeeper. You know, he was kind of a moderate individual. We'll say more about that in a minute. But he's, you know, leave him alone. Let's not kill him. Let's not stir the pot here. All right. Let it go. Let God take care of it. So that's what he said in chapter 5. And understand, too, that the Jewish leadership listened to him. That implies something very significant, too, and that is they had a tremendous amount of respect, the leadership did, for Gamaliel. What do we know about this man historically? And this is interesting. I spent some time this week kind of digging it out because, you know, I knew certain things about Gamaliel, but here's some details that perhaps you didn't know. Gamaliel was a well-respected, but he was also a very lenient Pharisee. And by the way, that made what he taught very popular. It does today. If you're lenient, you're popular because people, you know, if you're lenient, I'm willing to follow you. And they kind of felt this way towards Gamaliel. But he was very well respected. He was a leader in the Sanhedrin. He was the grandson of the great Rabbi Hillel. There was Shammai and Hillel, particularly in the area of divorce. I think I've mentioned that before. But Hillel was one of the great rabbis of all times. And this man, Gamaliel, held the title of Rabban, which means our teacher or master. He was actually one of seven rabbis in all of Jewish history to whom the Jews gave that title. It was not a common title. It is more than rabbi, okay? It is one of tremendous and the greatest amount of respect. It was considered the highest title a teacher could be given. He's actually quoted a number of times even in the Mishnah. The Mishnah, and it was written later, is maybe the foundational legal text of Judaism. So here's Gamaliel mentioned in this foundational legal text. So this man is tremendously respected by everyone. He was also president of the Sanhedrin under Tiberius, Caligula, and Claudius. And he died 18 years before the fall of Jerusalem as an old man. He was even consulted by royalty concerning matters of Jewish law. So Paul's education was not just at the feet of anybody, okay, of any teacher. Paul's education was at the feet of Gamaliel, the well-respected, somewhat liberal rabbi, and one who was called Rabban because he was so respected. No doubt, Gamaliel was the greatest living authority and most revered figure in all of Judaism from AD 20 to AD 50. There was no one greater than Gamaliel. This is interesting because I think the Apostle Paul was kind of next in line. I think he would have been considered one of the greatest rabbis in all of history as well. He was on track to be that kind of an individual sitting at the feet of this great man. This man, Gamaliel, was also entitled The Beauty of the Law. That's how incredible this guy was. Erdman's Dictionary of the Bible says this about Gamaliel. Gamaliel was the head of the school of Hillel, the most lenient and therefore most popular form of Judaism, as we said. He consistently ruled on matters of Jewish law in ways that translated his moderate pragmatism into day-to-day life. Indeed, he was pragmatic. If God is in this, we can't stop it. But if he's not, it'll be destroyed. All right? That was his advice in chapter 5. He goes on. He was especially concerned to ease the burden on women and the poor. His rulings were commonly based on the guiding principles of promotion of the common good and promoting the ways of peace. Again, that explains Acts 5. Gamaliel focused on the importance of study and the student and the teacher-student relationship. He reached out to Jews living in the diaspora, in other words, who were spread out, and was quite tolerant of Gentiles, as were his pupils and descendants after him. Like Hillel before him, Gamaliel stood almost alone in his love for the Greek language. It was studied in his school, and he even declared it the only language into which the Torah could be perfectly translated. Isn't that interesting? Paul knew Greek. There's a reason. Well, came from the city he did, but Gamaliel sure didn't object to it. In fact, he supported that. Notice, he continues in verse 3, educated under Gamaliel, strictly according to the law of our fathers. The word strictly is used only here in the New Testament. The word means strict conformity to a norm or standard, exactness, precision. Strictly, precisely, according to the law of our fathers. He held to it. He was serious about this. So why would Paul all of a sudden freak out and start bringing Gentiles into the temple? Being zealous for God just as you all are today. He's establishing that he is a well-trained, top of the line, well-trained Jewish person. He obviously would not drag Gentiles into the inner part of the temple. Also, he's establishing that he was just as they are, so that he might find common ground before he shares his testimony with them. By the way, great tactic. Finding common ground before you share your testimony. You know, I was just like you are. And I knew I was a sinner. I had come face to face with my sin and my guilt. And I came to know Christ. See, forming that common ground so people understand, you know, you're dug from the same pit I am, you know. You came to know Christ. Wow. So establish that commonality between people to whom you share the gospel. That's what Paul did. Being zealous for God just as you all are today. Paul was always taking the opportunity to point to Jesus, even when it was not advantageous for him to do so. Well, it sure isn't. He could be killed here. The riot could continue, but he insisted he wanted to talk to the people. He wanted to share his testimony. Verse 4, I persecuted this way to the death, binding and putting both men and women into prisons. Well, now we see his activity. And it wasn't good activity. He persecuted this way, and that's what they called it. I am the way, the truth, and the life. They called it this way. And notice, to the death. He was responsible for men and women dying, binding them, putting men and women into prisons, taking mothers from their children and husbands from wives and wives from their husbands, whatever it was, and throwing them in prison for their testimony. He was vicious. Look at Acts 26 and verse 10 for a minute. Acts 26 and verse 10. And this is just what I did in Jerusalem. Not only, this is Paul, not only did I lock up many of the saints in prison, having received authority from the chief priests, but also when they were being put to death, I cast my vote against them. So he's responsible for people dying. Yes, kill them. He agreed. He cast his vote with those that said, kill the Christians. Absolutely. So now Paul establishes that he had the ambitions and the zeal of a good Jewish person too. We don't consider this good, but the Jews would have. He was zealous to the point where he persecuted those whom he viewed as wandering away from the pure Jewish faith. So Paul was not favorably predisposed to the gospel, was he? Yeah, he was just right on the edge. He was ready to receive Jesus at any moment. No way. Christ had to shake him and get a hold of him. This is no simple conversion. He was stubborn in his disbelief that could only be changed by a supernatural intervention. Folks that he's talking to, men, he's saying, this could only be changed by God himself because I was so bent on destroying, stamping out Christianity. I hated him. I wanted him gone. Verse 5. As also the high priest and all the council of the elders can testify. His testimony, he's saying, is verifiable by the leadership. Let them tell you. Fruchtenbaum said, the high priest at this time was Ananias. He and the elders could testify that Paul had received letters of authority from Caiaphas, who was still living, to go to Damascus to find Jewish believers there. Then he was to bring them also that were there unto Jerusalem in bonds to be punished. Paul's zeal even led him to pursue Jewish believers outside the land with the intent of bringing them to Jerusalem for punishment, extraditing them. His point here was that he did not go to Damascus to find the Messiah, but to persecute his followers. See, he wasn't on the road to Damascus because maybe I want to explore being a Christian. No, he was on the road to Damascus to go find Christians to drag them back to Jerusalem in order for them to be punished. That's what he was doing on that road. God had a plan for him. And it would have to be dramatic. It would have to be supernatural. Paul's not going to change just because someone told him this, that, or the other. He wouldn't have believed him. So we find now in verses 6 through 11, Paul's Damascus road experience and salvation. Notice verse 6. But it happened that as I was on my way approaching Damascus about noontime, a very bright light suddenly flashed from heaven all around me. And I fell to the ground and heard a voice saying to me, Saul, Saul, why are you persecuting me? And I answered, who are you, Lord? And he said to me, I am Jesus the Nazarene, whom you are persecuting. And those who were with me saw the light, to be sure, but did not understand the voice of the one who was speaking to me. Verse 10. And I said, what shall I do, Lord? And the Lord said to me, get up and go on into Damascus, and there you will be told of all that has been appointed for you to do. But since I could not see because of the brightness of that light, I was led by the hand by those who were with me and came into Damascus. So how could such a staunch Jew, stubborn Jew, become a follower of Jesus Christ? This is the first time in Acts that Paul retells his Damascus road experience. Now, we learned about it. Luke told us about it. But here, Paul relates it himself for the first time. He will do it yet again in chapter 26. But until then, we will save that portion of Scripture. Notice now, verse 6. It happened that I was on my way approaching Damascus about what time? Noontime. Let me ask you, what is the brightest time of the day generally, particularly in the Middle East, when you don't have a lot of clouds and that sort of thing around? What would be the brightest time of the day, do you think? About this time, right? Noontime? No question about it. But notice what it says. About noontime, a very bright light suddenly flashed from heaven all around me. When you say a bright light, that's probably an understatement, okay? Because this had to have been just absolutely an incredibly bright light to eclipse the light of the sun at noon. So it was midday when the sun was at its brightest, and this light of the Shekinah glory of God was brighter than the light of the sun to the point that it blinded Paul. And notice the text says it flashed from heaven all around me. Flashed is the same word used in the Acts 9 account of Paul's conversion by Luke. And the word means to flash or shine around, to become illuminated all around. So in other words, the area became illuminated all around the Apostle Paul. I've seen some paintings and pictures at times of Paul looking up and he's illuminated. It's like he's under an incredible spotlight. But this spotlight is brighter than the light of the sun. And it's flashing all around him. It's shining all around him. Absolutely amazing. And notice it says from heaven. So we see the origin of the light. It's from God himself, from Jesus Christ, and from his presence, from his glory.
Verse 7, and I fell to the ground and heard a voice saying to me, Saul, Saul, why are you persecuting me? I fell to the ground. By the way, this is a natural Jewish response when confronted with the presence of God. We find out in the book of Revelation that John falls at the feet of angels, and the angels say, no, 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 don't worship us. Worship God. We're not the ones you should be worshiping. But when confronted with the presence of God, it was common to fall to the ground. And so we see that here. He falls to the ground. He knows something is supernatural here. This is not normal. And notice what he says to Paul. He says, Saul, Saul, why are you persecuting me? Not why are you persecuting Christians? But you see, God takes this seriously. By the way, I think God takes it seriously when people dishonor and persecute his church too. God takes it personally, and I'm talking about today. When people persecute the church today, I think when Christians talk about other Christians and talk about other churches and try to destroy other churches and try to gossip about other churches, I think God takes that very seriously too. Why are you persecuting me? Not Christians, but me. And there are some Christians that love to just rag on churches and rag on other Christians and say horrible things about them and gossip about them. You know, imagine someone saying something derogatory about your bride, the one you're married to, your bride. Would you take that seriously? I would. I would. I would say, you've offended me. Not just, you've offended my wife. No, you've offended me. Because you offend my wife, you offend me. You know, the church is called what? The bride of Christ. I think Jesus Christ gets very upset when people insult his bride. But there are so many Christians today who want to cause trouble in churches, cause dissension. I'm smarter than you are. Then they go out and gossip. I remember some years ago, there was a lady who was a deacon's wife, and she and her husband left the church, first church I pastored in Omaha, Nebraska. She and a few others left the church. Long story, anyhow, but horrible. Horrible situation. God called me there to help split the church, to make it purer church. And it was after that. It was. Praise the Lord for that. I was just called for a very unique ministry. And so it was a very difficult situation. But this lady went out into the community and gossiped about the church. Gossiped about the church. I heard it from another couple that I had never met before who came into the church and said, we've heard about you. This is what they said. This is a few weeks before I left the church. We've heard about you, but what we've heard, we agree with, and that's why we're here today. I appreciated that. That was actually encouragement. I thought at first, oh boy, Lord, you know, please don't let me be kicked while I'm down, but it wasn't. They were wonderful people. Gave me a book. Wonderful, wonderful people, older people, I'd say probably in their 70s at the time. I would say, wouldn't you? Maybe 80. Interesting anyhow. More to say about that, but I won't. But, you know, this lady, I heard later, became very ill. You know, it's interesting, God doesn't like it when his bride is insulted. He doesn't like it. Saul, why are you persecuting the church? No, why are you persecuting me? The body of Christ, the head. Christ, which is the head of the church, which is his what? Body. He takes it very seriously. Someone comes up to you and kicks you in the knee. Do you take it seriously? Why are you persecuting me? Who are you, Lord? By the way, when he says, Lord, I've had people say, well, he's asking, is he God? I don't think so. Remember now that the word Lord was a term of respect. I don't think here at this point, it will be next. But at this point, the word Lord is not a confession of who he is, but it is a term of respect. Who are you, Lord? I am Jesus the Nazarene whom you are persecuting. That name, Jesus the Nazarene, is not mentioned in the other accounts. But notice, I am Jesus the Nazarene whom you are persecuting. I'm the one. He identifies himself exactly who he is, so that Paul has no question about who this one is. Verse 9, and I said, what shall I do, Lord? And here I think at this point, as he uses the word Lord, he knows what he's saying now. Kurios, you are God. You are Yahweh of the Old Testament. And I said, what shall I do, Lord? And the Lord said to me, get up and go on into Damascus. And there you will be told all that has been appointed for you to do. All that has been appointed for you to do. Notice, he says, Lord, now in a more theological sense. He knows now who this is. And he says, get up and go on into Damascus. In other words, complete the journey. It's going to be for very different reasons now, but I want you to complete the journey. And there you'll be told of all that has been appointed for you to do. The word appointed means to give instructions as to what must be done, to order, to fix, to determine, to appoint. It's going to be fixed for you. It's going to be ordered for you what to do. Paul's calling had already been determined by God. He called him with a purpose and for a reason. And you know, he calls each one of us for a purpose and for a reason, and that is to glorify his name, to share the gospel with others, to make disciples. Are you fulfilling your purpose? Notice verses 14 and 15. And he said, the God of our fathers has appointed you to know his will and to see the righteous one and to hear an utterance from his mouth, for you will be a witness for him to all men of what you have seen and heard. Now, we haven't gotten there yet, but I want you to notice here, he's appointed him for a purpose. He's appointed Paul for a purpose. And lastly, let's notice verse 11, but since I could not see because of the brightness of that light, I was led by the hand by those who were with me and came into Damascus. Imagine Paul not being able to see. How unsettling that must have been. Kind of kicking him off kilter, kicking the slats out of his life. And here he is having to hold somebody in order to be led into the city of Damascus. The proud apostle Paul, coming in to persecute Christians, now humbly comes in as a blind man to receive orders from God. Amazing, isn't it? Amazing. I hope tonight, as we close the service, that you've considered these things, the lessons, the importance of sharing the gospel. Paul here standing in front of others is that could riot on him at any minute, that could tear him apart, was now sharing the gospel with these people, or at least working towards it at this point. He's going to be cut off here. We'll see that next week. He's going to be cut off here in the future. But are you willing to take the gospel to a lost world? Are you willing to even just invite people to church? I hope you are.